します。
いや、well, I was going to start by saying that this is the evangelistic rhythm of the introvert and make sure that you're in the right place, but knowing that if you are an introvert, you're probably not going to get up and leave if you are in the wrong place. I want to draw the attention to yourself. Well, let's go ahead and get started. I want to welcome you and thank you for joining me this morning. We are at the tail end of the lectureship, and I'm sure you've kind of been feel like you've been shot with a fire hose with a lot of good information. But I want to thank you for joining us. I know many of you, and many of you I don't know, and I just wanted to put my information up here if you want to. If you have any questions about anything that I share, or you want to interact a little further on some of this, my email address is Jeff, J-E-F-F, at magcenterchurch.com, M-A-G-C-E-N-T-E-R, church.com. And I'd love to interact with you about this. Just to share with you a little bit about my own personal journey with evangelism. I grew up a preacher's kid, and yet as a child growing up, I really only had two experiences that I can think of with trying to talk to somebody that at least I knew that they didn't go to a church. The first was I was in about fourth grade. And our church, we were doing some kind of Friends Day event, and I invited my girlfriend to come, and I was extremely nervous about her coming, about her being there, the two worlds kind of interacting there, from school and church that didn't normally intersect. It was kind of intimidating, and after the worship service, we had a spaghetti dinner, and I was dressed in all white because I was a fan of Miami Vice, and Don Johnson was one of my heroes, and you're kind of jumping ahead of me. You see where the story is going, and eating the spaghetti dinner, I was cutting the spaghetti and dumped the entire plate on my lap. And my best friend, who I still interact with occasionally at the time, he still reminds me to this day. Hey, you remember that time you invited that girl and you dumped the spaghetti in your lap? And, still to this day, it brings up all kinds of negative emotions, negative memories. The second was at the age of 16, I had the opportunity to go with my dad and my uncle on a mission trip for about 4 weeks to Slovakia. And it was the first time that I'd been out of the country. We were teaching people English using the Bible. And one of the first days that we arrived there, we went to one of the popular shopping areas to pass out flyers for our classes that we were holding. And I don't know how many flyers we printed up, but there was a big stack of flyers that we had printed up, and we distributed them between the three of us equally and kind of scattered around this shopping area, and we're passing out flyers to people. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, my dad comes and he comes to get more flyers from me because he'd already passed out all of his, and I still had mine left. And then a few minutes later, my uncle comes over, and he's getting extra flyers. He's out, and I still have some left. And it seemed like they came back 3 or 4 times, and I'm still sitting there. And I realized as I stopped to watch what they were doing is every person that walked by, they were handing the flyer to, and I had a dialogue that was going on in my head about all the people that were walking by. You know, I would look at them and I would say, oh, she's too pretty. You know, I can't talk to her. Or he looks too cool, you know. I don't want them to come to something like this. Or maybe I'd look at them and say, you know, she has more hair on her legs than I do. This was Europe, and they didn't always practice some of the same hygiene that we did. And I share those stories with you because there is a pretty significant disconnect between the message that we are presenting from the stage and what we know our own experience of life is. See, I know that I was a preacher's kid, and then that's my only experience with evangelism up until about 2 years ago, and had spent 8 years in ministry at that time. That all of my energy was focused with those that were already in the church that I was a part of, which is good, and we need those relationships. And yet, it was neglecting something that is so central to the gospel. I'm sure that every one of you here this morning, that your church has a part of its mission statement in some capacity, a connection with the Great Commission. That in some language, whether it is reaching the lost or evangelizing, some language that we use to convey this is a core part of who we are. And from the stage, we will tell stories about reaching people and talking to somebody and how they have this radical conversion, and then we're sitting in our pews and we don't have that experience. Some of that is because of the way in which we imagine evangelism and the way in which we imagine introversion. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time this morning defining those two terms. I'm going to assume that in some capacity, if you're here, that you have some concept of that. But what I want to do very briefly at the beginning is we'll kind of reimagine introversion, and then towards the end we'll kind of talk about what evangelism really looks like today. But according to Josh McDowell, less than 5% of Christians share their faith. Less than 5% of Christians share their faith. And this is coming from people that as I said, we have this included in our mission statement that this is what we do, and we have this belief that God is in control, that God wins, and yet we have so much fear and anxiety that prevents us from engaging with others. Josh McDowell also says that less than 2% of Christians know that the Great Commission calls them to make disciples. So it's not just enough this is what we do as our church. Whenever I first moved to Riverside, California 2 years ago, as I was getting to meet people, I would just kind of ask them a number of questions. One of the questions that I would frequently ask people is, when was the last time that you invited somebody to church? Just trying to gauge, you know, how people viewed their role in this church and how involved and connected they were with the ministries that were going on. And I'll never forget that I asked a 16-year-old boy this, and his answer was so honest, and he said, I didn't know that I was supposed to. Didn't know that he was supposed to, and truth is, many of us don't even know how. The reality is that we can no longer afford to ignore the Great Commission. I don't know that we really ever could, because of the value of each individual soul that exists on this planet. But now, with the cultural shift that is taking place in America and the decline of church, we can't afford to ignore it for our own sakes. And the culture that is shifting, in some ways, I think, while we kind of view it to be very negative towards the gospel, in some ways it sets itself up for introverts. To be able to leverage the strengths that introverts have in reaching people for the gospel. Some of you may have been in Shane Hughes' lecture that was on empowering the introverts, and he did a great job of talking about how we can include people into our worship, into our community. And as a part of that, Shane mentioned that he believes that introverts can be the answer to our flippant Christianity. That it's very easy for us to just kind of want to say a prayer with somebody, get them wet, and then think that everything is okay. But because introverts are not satisfied with superficial engagement, that actually this cultural shift has some benefit. The postmodern world is very skeptical of meta-narratives, of large stories that try and make sense of everything in life, and very skeptical of power, of those in authority. Barna has shown research of the amount of respect that certain people garner within our culture, and you see one of the people that he frequently uses is Billy Graham, and you can see the downward trend that people just don't trust that kind of persona anymore. That truth has become very subjective today. That my truth may not be your truth, and it really doesn't even matter what is true. It matters what works. And so the myth of that our Church of Christ kind of tradition has given to us is that the problem with non-believers is they just don't have the information. And if you give them the simple facts, and we kind of maybe you've heard the story of this kind of imaginary island, and a man that's stranded there has never heard of the gospel, never heard of Jesus at all, and a Bible washes up on that island, and he opens up the Bible and begins to read that Bible, that you know he's going to then begin to engage in worship, engage in faith in the way that we do in the Churches of Christ. Because what's lacking is just information. But our world doesn't care about what is true. It cares about what is working. I've gotten kind of hooked on an energy drink called Zip Fizz. And supposedly it is a natural caffeine that, and I don't know how natural anything is that we digest or put into our bodies is anymore. But I don't really care. I don't even really care if scientifically it actually provides a boost of energy. All I know is that I experience it. It could be a placebo for all I care. All I know is that it works for me. And that's what our culture is asking. They're asking the question of what works. Ravi Zacharias, the apologist who travels the world and has opportunity to go into secular universities and argue for the existence of God and faith. He tells a story about going to a conference, and he hears later about a woman that invited her non-believing husband to come and hear him. And on the drive home, she was asking what he thought about the lecture. And he said, "You know, I thought he was really good." And then he said, "But I wonder what he is like in his private life." Because it doesn't matter that this stuff is just objectively true. What he wants to know is, does it make a difference in the way that he lives? Does it make a difference in the way that I live? And that led Ravi to ask this question: how do we communicate the gospel to a culture that hears with its eyes? So I think that introverts have the potential to be the answer to the superficial Christianity. But first, I want to talk about introversion and help us to reimagine what introversion is. Again, I'm not going to define the term a whole lot, but the horizontal spectrum here is just kind of the source of energy, internal versus external, a source of energy. And everybody falls somewhere on the spectrum. There's probably not a true introvert in existence, and there's probably not a true extrovert in existence, but somewhere we exist on this spectrum. And yet, our personalities are not that simple. It's a little bit more complex than that. And especially whenever it comes to something like sharing our faith with others. And so one other dimension that I want to draw our attention to is anxiety. And that wherever you are on this spectrum of introversion and extroversion, that we also have a certain level of anxiety, social anxiety, about the way that we think others will see us, or the way that we see ourselves in relationship to others. And we can be very highly anxious, or we can be very low in our anxiety. And my goal, and I think our goal, is not to change who God designed us to be. I'm convinced that introverts possess the imago Dei, the image of God, just as much as an extrovert does. And so we should not kind of have this end goal that we're going to be Bob Goff, right? I mean, I don't think the world would be very healthy if every person, you know, strived to have that level of energy and spontaneity. But what I think is unhealthy, and where we do work to improve, is with our anxiety. John writes that love casts out fear. And so as we work through this, you may not move, and as you mature in your own faith, you may not move to become more extroverted, but you may lower your anxiety, which will have the result of changing the way that you interact with people. And it may have the appearance of being more extroverted, but that energy source will stay the same. And so I think having this picture in our mind, it's been helpful for me and for others that I know of as well. But the important part of the title of this class that I want to spend our time on is the idea of rhythm. As the Church of Christ, we are not known for having rhythm. We weren't allowed to go to dances, and many of us, we weren't allowed to clap in churches with our songs, and we did not observe the liturgical calendar. And so the rhythm of you know, the theme of the lectures, the scrolls, and how they're tied to the festivals of the Jewish calendar, you know, we're not familiar with that idea of rhythm, and yet it's core to every aspect of life, of nature. You see rhythm in the waves. You know, they have an ebb and flow to them, light with the sun. We have our day and night. Our bodies are designed to function with this rhythm of rest and work. And even the largest of human bodies, the most muscular people. I heard an interview recently with a bodybuilder, and he was talking about steroids and other enhancements. And he said, you know, it's a myth that those things that it actually creates muscle. That what they actually do is they increase the speed at which somebody repairs. And so the rest period is shortened. And so even somebody that is a bodybuilder, they still rest. But because of the supplements that they're taking, that they're able to rest less and their body is able to recover. But they still have this rhythm of exertion and rest. And so I want to share with you five movements that I think are helpful in kind of getting us into a rhythm of evangelism. The first is solitude and silence. Now, these five rhythms, I believe, are necessary for wherever you fall on the spectrum. But they may function, they may serve different purposes on your own unique personality. With solitude and silence, the idea is not to use solitude as a safe haven, which I think many of us tend to use solitude as, and may even use introversion as an excuse for avoiding social interaction. And I would argue that that's actually more of the anxiety than our own energy source. And so the solitude is serving the purpose of a charging station. I like to think of it like a laptop. My wife kind of makes fun of me at times because I bought a laptop, but I don't really use it as a laptop. I struggle to see any kind of battery. If it gets below 80%, I start getting very anxious. And so I have a laptop. I have an 11-inch MacBook. It's tiny, but I'm always plugged in to a wall. And she looks at me and says, why do you have a laptop if you're not going to get out into the world? You're not going to use that energy. I think it's the same with our own energy levels. That solitude isn't meant to be a refuge as much as it is a charging station. And you see this rhythm in Jesus himself. I don't know if Jesus was an introvert or an extrovert, but what I do know is you see Jesus engaging in a rhythm. Luke chapter 6, verse 12 says that one of those days Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. And this is something you see Jesus do frequently. He does it before his ministry. He does it at the end of his earthly ministry. You see Jesus doing it here in Luke 6 as he's preparing to choose his 12 disciples. You see Jesus doing it whenever the crowds come and they want to take him as king by force. So he's very successful. It's after a big win. He retreats into solitude. He has this rhythm of solitude and then community and then ministry. So verse 13 goes on and says that when morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. And the next three verses, you know, give us the names of those apostles, and he calls them to be with him. And then later on, he went down with them and stood on a level place. A large crowd of his disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem, and from the coastal region around Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by impure spirits were cured, and the people all tried to touch him because power was coming from him and healing them all. So what happens, what is served by the solitude and silence for us? I think that there are two benefits that we receive. The first is that we discover our own belovedness. Jesus begins his ministry by going off into the desert. He begins his ministry with a baptism, and there's the pronouncement from heaven that this is my Son whom I love, with him I am well pleased. And then he goes off into the desert to face temptation. In Matthew 17, Jesus goes up on the mountain to pray. And he meets there with Elijah and Moses. And then he moves out into the final days of his life. And on that mountain, he receives the affirmation again. This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. And whenever you look at both of those contexts, it seems to indicate that Jesus is the only one that hears that voice. That others, they may hear a sound, but it's Jesus that hears this voice. So Jesus needs this affirmation that he is the beloved of God, that he begins his story in Genesis chapter 2, not in Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 2 begins with that God speaks a blessing over humanity. And it's only after he blesses them that then he provides work for them. If you noticed in the stories that I shared of my experience of evangelism, they were about me. That my concern was how others were seeing me. Because my sense of identity is drawn from other people. Really, everybody's is. I mean, how can you define who you are outside of relationship? If you were to define yourself, you might use terms like kind. You might define somebody else as being unkind or angry. All of those are relational terms. You can't be kind by yourself. We do not know ourselves outside of relationship. Now, the danger comes when we place too much weight in what others think of us. And solitude and silence provides us a secure identity, a secure base, which removes the pressure from all social interaction. I don't need your approval because I already have God's approval. That the words that I use, it doesn't carry the weight of my identity. Henry Nouwen said that when you are not claiming the voice of God speaking as the beloved, that you cannot walk freely in this world. And I think that's true. So solitude and silence, it helps us to discover our own belovedness. But secondly, as we discover our own belovedness, we discover the belovedness of others. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 14, Paul says that Christ's love compels us. That's in the context of him talking as living as an ambassador in this world. And I think that what Paul is talking about is not that in some sense that he is he is filled with God's love, and then it just kind of pours out of him, as much as it is that the love of Christ for the world compels him to engage with people. I have three daughters, and my interests have changed over the last 20 years, from before I was married to now being married and having three daughters. I didn't enjoy much music. I did not. Sports essentially was my world. And this week I have watched more Rainbow Bright in our room than I have of the NBA playoffs. And it's not really because I enjoy Rainbow Bright as much, it's that my daughters do. And that their love compels me, because I want to engage with them, that their love compels me to love what they love. Perhaps we miss the boat whenever we talk about being a relevant church or presenting relevant messages. The point of relevance is love. Just go and read the letters that Jesus gave to the churches in Revelation. Those are very relevant messages. He speaks of aspects that are indigenous to that city. You know, whenever he speaks about being lukewarm, you know, there's the hot spring and the cold spring, and you know, that's something that he's being relevant to them. But the point is love. It's not just relevant for relevancy's sake, but it is love. Bertrand Russell said that love was an unsatisfied need of his. Somebody who was agnostic and a brilliant mind, he had two loves. It was religion and mathematics. And he said that mathematics was the only thing that kept him from committing suicide. That he is there alone and isolated. So solitude and silence is the first rhythm, or first movement that we can make to engage in rhythm. The second movement is prayer. And I don't want this to sound flippant, because I think it's much greater than that. So consider these passages. John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life." This verse communicates that God loves every soul, every human being. God loves them enough that he sent his Son. So that's just reminding us of who God is. Whenever Jesus is sending out his disciples to go and preach the good news, in Luke chapter 10, he tells them, "When you enter a house, first say peace to this house. If someone who promotes peace is there, your peace will rest on them. If not, it will return to you." Now, my question is, how is there someone of peace already there? If they are the ones taking the gospel out, then what this is telling us is that God has already gone before them. In the same way that God promised the Israelites and Joshua, as Joshua is conquering the promised land and said that I'm going to go before you, that God is going ahead. John 16:8, when the Holy Spirit comes, he will prove the world to be in the wrong about sin and righteousness and judgment. God is the one who convicts. God is the one who converts. Paul writes that I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God has been making it grow. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. So we have God that loves every human being more than we are capable of. And God is saying, I'm going to be the one that is responsible for convicting and converting people. And whenever you look at Paul's image of agriculture and saying that he planted, Apollos watered, the only person that is necessary in that equation is God giving the increase. The plants, they get into the seeds get into the ground, and God waters the earth. Agriculturally speaking, the only one that is necessary is God. And so whenever I say that we need to make a movement of prayer, it is not just, oh, pray and everything is okay. But it is rooted in a conviction that God cares more about people than others, than we do. And so it makes sense for us to speak to God about those that we care about. So I want to tell you a story about a couple of people that I've been trying to form relationships with. Our church is right across the street from an elementary school. And so I've been trying to form relationships with the school and some of the parents of the school. And the story is about two men that I'll call Tim and Jim, primarily because that's what their name is. But I've been on this journey of trying to become more evangelistic over the last couple of years and getting some coaching from Stan Granberg. Some of you know who he is. And he encouraged me to make a list of people and begin to pray for them. And so I did that. And after one of our coaching sessions, it was late in the afternoon that I was leaving the office. It was about 4:30 or so. And the school gets out normally about 2. And so I didn't expect anybody to be in the parking lot. But that day, without my knowledge, there was a council meeting that had just gotten out. And Tim and Jim were out in the parking lot. So I walked up to them and just started talking with them for a minute. And Tim, just in the middle of this conversation, says that he is an atheist or an agnostic, and he looks over at me, but we've already talked about that before. And I said, no, wait a minute, we haven't talked about that before. And he says, really? And I said, no, we haven't talked about that. I'd love to hear about your story. And that happened the day that Stan challenged me to begin praying, and I chose those two men to begin praying about. That doesn't happen all the time. You know, just instantaneously, I pray about somebody, and you know, this divine opportunity presents itself where we can engage in conversation. But we don't need to neglect the power of prayer. The third movement is to go. And this is where, for introverts, our anxiety begins to increase a little bit. We're moving from that kind of charging station to unplugging and moving out into the world. And so what I want to do is to provide some ways of thinking about this that keeps our anxiety level at a healthy range. You know, my anxiety level is manageable anywhere from like a 4 to a 7. If I get over a 7, then I start to shut down. And so let's think about what it means to go and how introverts can use their uniqueness for this. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says that you are the light of the world, A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Speaking to those who are beginning to follow Jesus, he says that you are light. The placement of light is critical. If you've been involved in the building of a house, or maybe you have bought a house and there were not lights in the house, and maybe you had to get lamps, the placement of lights is a critical decision that maybe you don't think about, but God has. And so Paul in Acts chapter 17 says that from one man God made all the nations that he should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. So if God is doing that for the nations, well, what are nations? It's people, right? So if God is marking out the territory of where the United States is going to be, where Russia is going to be, where Mexico, Canada, you know, all these nations are going to be, then it makes sense that God is going to mark out the times and the boundaries of you. So what is your boundaries of your land? We'll come back to that in just a moment. Mark 5, you have Jesus healing the man who's possessed by a demon, or by the legion of demons, and he tries to get in the boat with Jesus, and Jesus says, no, you go home to your own people and tell them how much he has done for you. So go doesn't necessarily mean to leave your boundaries. Where your territory is it's where you work. It's where you live. It's where you play. It's your family. It may even be the divine appointments where you just happen to be at the same place with somebody else. And some special consideration for those of us that are introverts is one, to think about owning your space. So I mentioned that I have three daughters, and one of them is very clearly going to be on the introverted end of the spectrum. She is, from the time she was an infant, was very sensitive to sound and other noises. Whenever she was a toddler, I worked at a small church of 70 people. We lived right across the street from the church. And whenever we would get to church, if there were other people in the building and they came up to talk to her, she would just immediately freeze and look down. And my wife and I would have to get down into her field of vision so that she could see us, and then she would jump up into our arms. But then after about 5 or 10 minutes, she was okay, and she was running around as if it was her own house. Now, if we had gotten there first and other people were coming in, she was okay because she was already acclimated to that environment. She had owned her space. And that's not just something that children experience. That's something that adults experience as well. If I'm coming to an event late and it's noisy, there's a lot of things going on, a lot of other stimulus, I can very easily become overwhelmed and shut down. But if I am there before those that I'm trying to interact with, then I feel more comfortable. I'm owning this space. And I think if we be more intentional about the way that we view our territory, that we choose intentionality over convenience. It's very easy to not talk to anybody. We can pay our bills online. You can do your banking online. You can pay for your gas at the pump. It's very easy to go throughout your week and never see anybody Sunday to Sunday for many of us. And so it's not so much about where you go as much as being intentional when you're there. I talked with one woman that she She chose to use the train to commute. She lives here in L.A., and that commute becomes a time for her to interact with people, and it's what's key is that it is a predictable amount of time. So the commute is over, and she doesn't have to interact any longer. Right? And so for introverts, being strategic with the times and the amount of time. The fourth movement is to move into conversation. And I know that this, again, increases the anxiety and the pressure, can be crippling for introverts. But if we reimagine what evangelism is, evangelism, I think, is less about conversion and more about conversation. Don't have time to get into John 9 a whole lot, but go and look at the spiritual journey that the blind man has there. You know, he starts with his faith with Jesus, and he just calls Jesus a man in verse 11, and then in verse 17 he refers to him as a prophet, and then in verse 33 Jesus says that I am the man of God. And verse 37, he says, Lord, I believe, and he worships him. See, it's not just this instantaneous conversion, but it's a process. I heard someone say once that it takes 20 bumps, 20 positive interactions to move someone who is an unbeliever into faith. And I don't know where that number came from. Again, maybe it's not even important whether or not it's true, but it works. It lessens the anxiety because I don't have to convert them right now, but I can provide a positive interaction. I don't have a whole lot of time to get into this, but this so it's not just introverts that are more complex, but non-believers are more complex. This is called the gray matrix, if you'll just search the gray matrix, you can find a lot of information on this. But people don't just have a lack of information, but there's also, they have some kind of attitude towards Christians and the gospel. They have some prior experience. So some of them are open and some of them are closed. So evangelism is not just about presenting the gospel, but it's also about providing positive interactions that can move them in a stance where they're more open to hearing the good news. Stan Granberg, in his emerging leadership book on sharing faith, he has a helpful guide on how to have conversation. There's a three-question conversation. And you begin with the polite question, you know, the hi, how are you? And what this does is it acknowledges the presence of somebody else. It says, I see you. And that is invaluable not just to extroverts, but to introverts. God said that it's not good for man to be alone, and I think before that was a statement about marriage, that was a statement about humanity. And so, begin to just acknowledge the presence of somebody else. Like offering some kind of pleasantry. Then you can move to an interest question, make an observation about a shared experience, you know, the weather, the lectureship, any number of things. And that is moving beyond the superficial, but it's helping us to understand what they are interested about. And the next question is a caring question. This doesn't have to happen all in one conversation. It may happen over a period of months as you're intentional about going to the same place over and over again. That you begin to ask questions that show that you care. So with Jim, he shared with me one time that his mother was in the hospital. In fact, she had just died, and he was upset about it. So I told him that I'd pray for him, and I don't know, he told me that she was sick first. And I don't see them every day, even every week. It's just kind of whenever we happen to be in the parking lot at the same time. And it was 2 or 3 weeks later that I asked about his mother. And he just broke down in tears and he said, "You don't know how much it means to me that you remembered." So there is value in sharing this kind of caring question. The fifth movement is to invite. And part of that is inviting into our churches, into our communities, into our shared experiences. Andy Stanley has, I think, a helpful way to know when to invite somebody. He calls them the three knots. It's when somebody is not doing well. Then you say, you know, share how your faith helps you and to invite them into your church. When they're not in a church, invite them. Or when they're not prepared for. Transition moments kind of destabilize us. And we're open to new ideas, new experiences. And so if they're not prepared for having kids and all of a sudden they're pregnant, or they're not prepared for providing care for their parents, those transition times are helpful. But inviting is more than just inviting them to church. In 1998, 8,000 students were asked how they would respond if a friend came to them and they wanted to know about becoming a Christian, but they wanted to talk to the student. They didn't want to talk to a preacher. They didn't want to talk to a church leader. They just wanted to talk to their friend. So they asked 8,000 students, if you had a friend come and ask you, what would you say? And all of them mentioned engaging in some kind of spiritual practice or coming to church. Only 14% mentioned anything about Jesus. Mm-hmm. That was in 1998. And so those that are students are now adults. Our churches are failing at equipping our members on how to walk people across the threshold of faith. That we don't just need to do good works, but we have to be able to communicate the gospel. Romans 10:14, but how can they call on him to save them unless they believe in him? And how can they believe in him if they have not heard about him? And how can they hear about him unless someone tells them? We need to be able to communicate the gospel to help them to ask for Jesus to become the leader of their life, to ask for forgiveness. And finally, we need to remember that our goal, as what was communicated in one of the other lectures, our goal is to introduce them to Jesus, not our doctrine. Not even our churches. But to Jesus. So the end of Tim's story, at least at this point, the gentleman that I've been building a relationship that tells me that he's an atheist, I sit down with him and hear about his story, and he's had a lot of negative interaction with Christians, and I can understand why he doesn't want anything to do with faith. But after Easter, bumped into him, and he's been studying with a man that he's formed a relationship with that's a Seventh-day Adventist, and Tim told me, "I think I'm starting to believe." He said, "I'm not really sure exactly what I believe yet, but I think I'm starting to believe." And my response was what yours is, you know, wow. And yet it's very easy for us to know he's studying with the Seventh-day Adventist. We're going to have a lot of doctrinal differences, some things that we want to fix. But that may not be the time, and there may not ever be the time. The goal is to introduce him to Jesus, not into my church. And I think that if we can engage in some of these movements, that maybe we can begin to make a difference in our world. Thank you for your attention.